Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This week we're entering the political sphere with Alistair Campbell. The latest edition of his diaries relived the years between 2010 and 2015, encompassing the rise of Cameron, the era of Ed Miliband, and the spectacle that was the Olympics. For Campbell, it was also a time of personal turmoil, with his son slipping into alcoholism and Campbell himself suffering from poor mental health. He is here to talk through this fascinating era with us. Welcome. Alistair Campbell, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. We're here to talk about the latest edition of your diaries, which is a rollicking read and very big and so full of interesting things. I don't think I'm going to be able to get the chance to ask you about them all.
But did you say rollicking?
Yes, I think that's the right word.
Okay, rollicking. Yeah, I think these are even longer than the previous ones because they cover more years, 5 years crammed in.
Yeah, I mean, 800 pages from 2010 to 2015. So it's really interesting to read just because it starts off with you kind of, you out of government, you know, after all your years with Tony Blair. So I kind of just wanted to start off by asking you, like, what were your main feelings, like, coming down off the high, I suppose, of being so involved with the government? Like, what was that like for you? And then what was that like for your family as well?
Well, it's kind of strange. And, you know, you'll have seen that I was obviously very sad that Labour had lost. But at the same time, those kind of crazy days after the 2010 election when, you know, it to some extent it felt like we hadn't lost because we at least stopped them getting a majority, which I think is what most people thought was going to happen. But that being said, I mean, I do remember, you know, Gordon Brown walking down the streets of Downing Street and down Downing Street with his wife and his children and then seeing Cameron and Clegg come in. And I think I say on page one of the diaries, you know, listening to the news. And when I heard the BBC reporter talking about bird song in the garden as Cameron and Clegg did their thing, I thought, no, I can't face this. And so very, you know, very mixed feelings because, of course, I'd sort of been trying to get out anyway. I mean, I'd left and then I'd gone back and I'd left again and I was being sort of dragged back in. And I feel going through the whole of my diaries, I'm in this constant conflict where I'm being yanked back in when I'm sort of trying to get back out. And you mentioned the family. I mean, it's, you know, it was quite difficult at times with Fiona and my partner and also the kids sort of enjoying it, but sort of not. And very, very mixed feelings, I'd say.
I imagine after being wired into politics, like, it's almost like a high, and it does feel a little bit like you kind of come crashing down at the start, kind of trying to readjust to life without constantly being like plugged into the political circuit and trying to make things happen.
That's right. I mean, it is hard. It's like, I mean, I'm finding it very, very hard at the moment just watching this government, which I just, you know, the Tories have been in for 11 years now if you count the coalition years. And, like, you think they're so bad, and I do, and I know a lot of other people do as well, and yet they're kind of ahead in the polls, and, you know, and you feel powerless, you know, you feel like... So I kind of... And it's really interesting doing the diaries. I mean, there's sometimes when I'm in the process of doing them, I'm thinking, oh, God, here we go again. It's the same old stuff and the same old arguments and the same old people. And yet last night was really, really interesting. So this, if you think about... What's kind of really big in this volume? You've got the Leveson inquiry. Well, last night, turned on the news, and one of the top stories was Prince Harry and Prince Meghan being sort of, you know, private detective admitting that he'd been sort of asked to get into them, blah, blah, blah. And you think, what was Leveson about? When these same people who are still running the newspapers were saying, oh, we never do that. That's all the past. That doesn't happen anymore. And then an even bigger story last night was Nicola Sturgeon, this committee sort of saying she misled Parliament. And of course, a lot of the diaries is about, you know, the Scottish referendum and the independence debate and so forth. So I kind of feel, I feel sometimes like my own life, I'm living in these different time zones.
Yeah.
You know, so I know it's my own fault. I mean, I don't have to publish the diaries, right? But sometimes I feel I'm just trapped in this same old stuff.
Yeah, like trapped so close to the centre of things and kind of watching things unfold around you. I think you said something really interesting in the diaries, which is like, nobody can seriously argue that the press we get is the press we deserve. A spiral of decline has led to the tipping point. Do you think that's like, do you think that's still true? Do you think newspapers are still on a slide downwards, as it were?
Do you mean in terms of standards or sales or?
So I just thought in terms of standards.
I think, listen, I try, you know, I mean, my background was in journalism, so I really think journalism matters, particularly now. But I think it's very, very difficult for them. You know, they're under massive competitive pressures from social media. You know, if I think back to when I was a journalist, right, you know, working, say, as a political correspondent for The Mirror, I could really immerse myself in what I was doing. And then I probably wouldn't have to write anything until about 5 o'clock. So I could spend all day kind of talking to people, reading stuff, find out what's going on. I find now they have to, you know, they have to blog, they have to tweet, they have to do Instagram Live, they have to, if you're a BBC guy, you know, you kind of, you're talking on the Today programme, you're talking on the local radio, and I think, when do they have time to stop and really think and investigate and explore and analyse? And I think that does give in a, if you've got, bear in mind that most of our press is, I think, very right-wing, very biased. And so this government, I think, gets away with murder because journalists seem to me don't have the time really to get stuck in, added to which they don't necessarily have the, you know, even if they get really good stories, doesn't mean they're going to get them used properly, promoted properly. So I think our media's in a pretty bad way, to be honest. And then, you know, so in a way, this diary is the social media thing is really kind of taking off. But I still don't think we've worked through what the consequences are for politics and the impact that is having.
Do you think social media has made the political debate more partisan, more vicious than it would be otherwise?
I think yes and no. I mean, I think where I say yes, so for example, you have a, you know, during the, I mentioned the Scottish referendum, I think then you had a sense of that, you know, the SNP were being described as having, you know, much better at social media. But that was also leading to things like, do you remember the demonstration outside the BBC? Now, I've got my criticisms of the BBC, but I don't, you know, I wouldn't go that far. But I think it's in the sense, it's when a party manages to get its social media operation running as well as that. And I actually think that the current government, I mean, they are so active in terms, not just the sort of above the line, you know, the stuff you can see social media, but also the stuff that you can't necessarily see, all the bot stuff and the, you know, people bombarded on Facebook and the ads that we don't necessarily see because they're not coming to, you know, you're not getting them, I'm not getting them. I think that has created a new political landscape, which is, as I say, I don't think we've really thought it through, what's where that's leading. And so, you know, and I kind of, I do a good job of pretending that I understand what's happening with social media by doing tweeting madly and Instagram lives and stuff like that. But I'm not sure I do fully understand how it works and the impact that it's having.
Yeah, I think that's only starting to come to light now with all the stuff with Facebook and them appearing in front of the House of Commons and that kind of thing. But you are very active on social media. I know you do. You tweet regularly and you have your blog and you do... which I find quite interesting. During your book, you kind of do make a lot of references to, oh, I sent out a tweet, this tweet went, you know, was retweeted a lot, I wrote a blog on this. Like, to what extent do you feel like, you know, I realise you said you don't really know so much about what's going on with social media, but like, to what extent do you feel like you curate your online image and use your blog and Twitter as like a megaphone, I suppose, for your personal views?
Yeah, I guess I do, because partly that's where you can go out and speak. And I've noticed that, for example, I've been, you know, very critical of, say, Brexit and of the government over COVID. I've noticed that I think the BBC, I feel, has been trying to pull its punches quite a lot. And I've just noticed how, compared with, now maybe this is just the passage of time and there are more people out there, but I've noticed how infrequently I now get asked onto the BBC. To talk about, certainly to talk about those things. So like, and maybe it's because they think, well, it's happened and I'm not in Parliament and the People's Vote campaign, I was part of that and therefore I had that locus. But I think it's not really about that. I think it's that they just, they want the kind of voices that are not going to kind of go off on one about these subjects in the way that I probably would. And so, and it means that, you know, now, I'm not pretending that going doing my Instagram live that watched, you know, by a few hundred people live and might get sent out, might get retweeted and blah, blah, blah. It's not the same as, you know, getting on the telly and speaking to hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people at a moment in time. So it's not curating, but I think I still use it to say what I think, and then in a way not worry about where it goes. Because I think that's the... It's interesting, you know, when we go out walking on the heath in the morning, we've been going out with the dog every morning, and it's interesting how many people do stop and say, oh, I really liked your piece about so-and-so. And I think, what was that? And they mean actually one of the kind of mad rambles that I've done on Instagram. Whereas, you know, and it's... I think if you're on like, you know, Question Time, the Today programme, all those things that used to be, where if you're on those things, people would mention it for days thereafter. Mm. I don't know if that happens quite as much anymore.
No, I think it's social media has become the megaphone for most people, I think.
I don't like seeing it as a megaphone, though, because I do, funny enough, was it Mark Seddon who used to edit Tribune? He did a tweet yesterday. I'd written this piece for Tortoise saying that the problem with our media is all they do is fuel rage and polarisation. And Mark Seddon, he said, oh, there's Alistair Campbell complaining about rage. Alistair Campbell, who rages all day long. Now, I don't rage all day long, but I can see sometimes why I might give that impression. I do get really angry about this government and about the media coverage of it. And you shouldn't, you know... I just look at, there's so many situations where I think, oh my God, if that was Tony Blair, if that was Gordon Brown, you know, they'd be killing them. And you're seeing it with Nicola Sturgeon at the moment. You know, all the stuff about misleading Parliament or not, right? But I've not seen any of the people who are kind of haranguing, I've not seen any of the journalists, I've not seen any of them point out about Priti Patel. So that sort of double standard does my head in.
Yeah, and I do think, it is true with Labour. They have come in for a particularly rough ride, I suppose, most notably with Corbyn, but also with Ed Miliband going back a bit further, like the infamous Ed sandwich. I was, 16 at that time, and I can still remember it, so it must have...
And can you remember anything else from that campaign?
The Ed stone.
Right. You see, they're both really interesting examples of their kind. And I guess, this diary, Ed Miliband is one of the big figures within it because he's the leader of the Labour Party. And I supported David, but in a very half-hearted way, about which, as I say in the introduction, I now feel very guilty. But then I did go and help Ed. And actually, I think those things, that thing with the bacon sandwich, right? Now, if you just look at some of the stuff that we've had related to Johnson, right? The press just don't dive in, they don't pile in that way. So, for example, what would be an example? If Cherie had been the person spending £200,000 doing up the flat, right?
Mm.
They would keep going on about it day after day after day after day. This lot don't. They let them get away with it. And I think, so for example, Ed, okay, he looked a bit gawky with eating a... I don't think it even was a sandwich, wasn't it? Some sort of burger, I don't know. But it just doesn't matter. And also, you know the Ed stone, right? The Ed stone. I mean, I can see why people lampooned it, but actually, what's the difference between doing that and putting a poster up or a pledge card? It's just saying what you're going to do. It's a new way of trying to sort of make it graphic and pictorial and so forth. So I just think it shows that there's this kind of inbuilt bias the whole time. I'm not saying Ed would have won if you hadn't have had that sort of press going from him. And to be fair to Ed, one of the reasons they went so hard for him is he pushed hard for the Leveson inquiry. You know?
Yeah. There is a lot of push and pull in your diaries. You can see, David as well, the conflict between Ed and David, Ed kind of calling on you, like being quite needy almost. There was a lot of references to, like, Ed called again, like this kind of thing. Why do you think, do you think Ed's image problem was like evident from the start, or did it just, how big a role do you think it played in his defeat in the end?
I think Ed's got a lot of strengths, I do. But I think if you move away from the Labour Party, Labour Party members, Labour Party activists, and think about what the public, those members of the public that aren't that, you know, politics comes and goes and they don't think about it all the time, they don't listen to the programs that maybe you and I would listen to. They're just got to get on with their lives. I think they thought it was very, just a bit weird, the whole thing at the start of, oh, God, he's taking on his brother. Now, Ed, to be fair to him, people are entitled to this in politics. He thought he was offering something different. He was. It won. Now, but then I think the public also thought, but hold on a minute, David won in the trade, in the, among the MPs, he won among the members, Ed won among the trade unions. Isn't that a bit weird as well, that that's what helped him win? And then I think, I don't, I'm not sure he ever really got over that. And then, of course, you've got a narrative that's playing there the whole time. And it comes through in the diaries. I mean, you still get it, to be honest. I still get it going around the place. Oh, well, the trouble you lot, you picked the wrong Miliband. You know, the trouble you lot, you picked the wrong Miliband. You still get that. And so, now, whether it's true or false, we'll never know because he won. But, yeah, I think it was... I think it was... The, when I think this image stuff, when it plays out in the way that it does, it can be grossly unfair, and I think it is often with Labour leaders, grossly unfair, but the, usually there'll be a kind of... There'll be a deeper reality there that's being spoken to. And that, I think, was the deeper reality. People thinking, I wonder if they've got the wrong guy there.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, personally, I think Ed's great, but unfortunately, I don't think I was old enough to vote at that point. So
yeah, but listen, he's shown as well. The other quality that I really admire in politics is resilience and keeping going. And the ultimate in that is Joe Biden, who's become the president in his 70s, right? But you know, I think Ed has been of the Labour front bench under Keir. I think Ed has been the one that's kind of, you know, cuts through. He's still. He was up in the Commons the other day, and it was, you know, he cuts through, and maybe that's his he's got experience now of not just of working behind the scenes with Gordon, but then as a frontline cabinet minister, politician, leader going through a campaign. But yeah, the push pull, the tension inside my head and my heart is it hasn't stopped.
Yeah, I mean. I did also want to ask you, actually, because I know you said that you appear less now on like TV spots and that kind of thing, but a lot of the time in your diaries you do reference like appearing on big events like Question Time, and kind of a kind of running theme, I suppose, through those events is you reference a lot of your anxiety, like, oh, I took some pills and it was fine, I kind of got through it all right. I know you've been in the public eye for such a long time now, but does it ever get easier being in front of these like these massive audiences and these like forensic, these public appearances?
Yeah, definitely. Yes, it does, definitely. And most of the time, that though, when I have those kind of anxiety attacks and stuff, they are related usually to my mental health not being in good shape. I don't think they're being necessarily provoked by being, you know, in a difficult interview or at an event or whatever. Because sometimes they can happen in the, you know, places where I'm under no pressure at all. I might just be on a train and somebody comes and sits down and I'm having a kind of bit of a... But, you know, and also, I mean, when I do those, you know, some of them matter more than others, put it that, matter more than others. So, for example, you know, the book ends at I'm on the Question Time on the BBC the night after the election with John Swinney from the SNP, Paddy Ashdown... can't remember who else was on. Oh, Francis Maude for the government. And, you know, I think that maybe it matters less now, but those programmes matter. You know, you know you're going to be watched by a lot of people. So I work at them, and part of the working at them is to put myself under pressure, to feel a bit anxious, a bit nervous. What can go wrong? Everything's going to go wrong. And that's a way for me of kind of stopping it from going wrong by doing the work and doing the preparation. Unlike, I think, a lot of people in politics, I honestly have reached the point now where I don't care people... I really don't... You know, what the press say is what the press will say. It just doesn't bother me. There's no point letting it bother you. I bother when family or friends are... You know, if I do a radio thing or a telly thing and Fiona, my partner, says that was really shit or, you know... One of my kids says, "Why on earth did you say that? Why on earth?" That would bother me. But you know, the papers. There's a really funny thing at the moment I've noticed that it really makes me laugh. But for some reason, the Daily Express has clearly decided that I'm sort of clickbait, because they do stories that, about the most random things that I say and do. And they're always like, you know, so what will happen if I go, say they watch this podcast and say you ask me a question that says, yeah, but don't you think you're such and such? And they will do headline, Campbell's, Alistair Campbell savaged over blah. And it'll be like, or two people are going television and do an interview or radio, and two people will tweet something saying, you know, you're an idiot or you're a twat or whatever. Campbell savaged over claim that. And it's just like, it's hysterically funny. So, and I think, I don't know whether they think it bothers me, but I now look for it because I find it so funny. They'll probably now do a story, say, Paranoid Campbell Googles Express Stories. It's funny, it's funny. It is funny.
You just said, like, about you care when you're like, your family are involved, and I thought that's quite an interesting thing with your diaries, because you have obviously like the whole news side, the Labour side, the you know, exciting happening side, and then kind of a lot of personal stuff in your diaries, like stuff with your family, your son Callum, his alcoholism, that all made it in, which is kind of very vulnerable, I suppose. When I was reading it, I also felt like a bit of a lump in my throat at times. How did you decide how much of that you wanted to include in the diary? So you just include everything, or do you just go through and kind of edit out some bits?
Well, what I did with that is if I'm out there, which I am as a mental health campaigner, and I've always found being open about my own issues helpful to me. But, you know, your children are your children, and they're not you, they're different, they've got their own identity, their own personality and so forth. So what I did with that is I kept most of it in my draft. And then I basically said to Fiona and to Callum most importantly, because he's the one that it's about, in the sense of, you know, his alcoholism, touch wood, he's now 8 years sober, but, you know, I said to him, listen, if you want none of this in, I'll take it all out. If there's stuff in it that you think, no, I don't want that. And, you know, I think to his credit, he read it and said, no, it's fine. It's fine. His only comment actually was, he made a comment about a couple of other people, friends of his that I'd mentioned, about what they thought and what have you, that he thought maybe not that, but about himself, he was fine. Now, if he had have said, I don't want any of that in, I think it would have been unreasonable of me to say, even though it was a massive part of our life. You know, during this period, it was probably the biggest thing going on in our life. For all the politics in a way were almost becoming like a bit of a release from it. I could go to meetings with Ed Miliband or with, you know, whatever it might be, and at least I'm trying not to think about it, because I promise you, when you do have your own child who's descending into alcoholism in that way, especially me having had something similar, you know, a few years older than he was, I was 28, he was in his early 20s. It's, you just feel wretched and helpless. I mean, there were, honestly, for night after night after night, I think it comes out in the diaries, these insomniac nights where you just lying there thinking, what on earth do we do? But eventually...
Yeah. So you said something like, you're only as happy as your least happy child or something like that, which I think was quite...
Yeah, that's not original, by the way. That's not original.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, but I think it's true. I mean, I feel that very deeply, that if any of my children are struggling... You know, and it's not just Callum. We had Grace... having really bad anxiety when she was at university in Paris, and she had to come back. You know, I think it's difficult, but no, the Callum stuff's deep in a way, and it was a very, very, very difficult episode. And then, of course, the thing about, you know, one of the things I feel, you know, guilt about is the fact that, you know, my politics and my political life is so kind of fundamental. So there we are, Fiona and I are up in Scotland at this rehab place, and what happens? My phone starts going completely mad because Margaret Thatcher's died, right? And I'm being bombarded with bids to do. And of course, the political part of me wants to engage in that.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, you know, no, we've got to you know, we're here because we're here for Callum, to talk with Callum about Callum to a therapist and all that. But, you know, it's just sort of, you just sort of feel, like I said earlier about living in different time zones, you just feel, oh my God, Thatcher's died. That's a huge moment in the political life of the country. And I'm sort of, you know, meant to have something interesting and useful to say about it. And actually, sometimes it's just best to say, no, I'll say nothing, turn my phone off and forget it.
Yeah, there's that duality. And especially, I think, during the Olympics for you, that I think a lot of Callum's stuff was happening then, lots of, like, therapy and talk. So the two seem quite, like, inextricably linked almost in the diaries, at least for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the Olympics is another, you know, I mean, the book is called The Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit, because, I mean, even though we had a Tory government by then, and Cameron and Osborne sort of lording it over the Olympics, Johnson sort of exploiting it for all it's worth as London mayor, it felt very much part of the kind of new Labour project, in a way. And that's why, you know, Tessa Jowell is one of the people I've dedicated the book to. But at the same time, as you say, I was scrabbling around with everybody else trying to get tickets and calling in favours from mates or whatever. But it felt very, very strange. You had that whole thing going on with the family. I wanted to be part of the Olympics as a spectator, but I also felt this kind of political sense of it happening as well.
I just remember, like, for myself, just being there on the opening, not being the opening ceremony, sadly, but, like, watching on television, the kind of, almost like a national fervour that's gripped the country. Like, I've never really felt anything like it. It's just kind of patriotism, I suppose. But, in the, you know, in the long run, do you think the Olympics actually ended up being bad for the country? Like, in the, because the national feeling that it provoked, I feel like it curdled, and that's almost what led to Brexit. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you what I do. You know, I don't know if you remember the bits in the book where I'm trying to persuade, with Jeremy Hayward's support, Jeremy, the cabinet secretary, trying to persuade Cameron that coming out of the Olympics, they should, or not necessarily for all time, but make Olympic legacy and sport a fully fledged cabinet job, to try to make sure that it didn't just evaporate. And I agree with you. I think a lot of it is just kind of, you know, you had that amazing, the 2 weeks of the Olympics and then the Paralympics, and you just sense the whole country kind of, you know, it really felt special. And then it just kind of went. And I think it's because they didn't put the political muscle into saying, this has been amazing. How do we keep on to this? How do we hold on to this? How do we use it as the basis for something else? And I think that was a terrible mistake. I think Olympic legacy, where you took sport and made it part of housing policy, part of education policy, part of health policy, part of communities policy, you really embedded it. That's why, you know, your question hits the nail on the head as to why I called the subtitle of the book The Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit.
Yeah, I feel like the main thing it gave us was Boris Johnson.
Well, I can remember actually at one point, I was there just as a spectator, and I was going to the velodrome. I was between two of the venues, and Boris Johnson was arriving at one of the venues, and he was getting treated like a rock star. You know, people were shouting his name, Boris, you know, there, Boris, da da da. And I can remember, you know, partly it was about the whole, but if you remember, George Osborne got booed. Do you remember when he was doing one of the medal ceremonies? He got booed by the whole crowd. So it wasn't as if it was like the happy pill had been taken. Everybody was loving all politicians. Tessa was getting a lovely reception around the place. I remember, you know, one of the best days for me, Tessa took me on a tour of the Olympic Village. And she was just so happy that this thing that she'd fought so hard for, and it was happening. And so Osborne got booed. The reaction that Boris Johnson was getting was extraordinary, and I think you're right. It's what made him an international figure, and that helped him become leader of the Tory party. It helped him become so big in Brexit, and now look at the bloody mess we're in.
Yeah, so on that note, I suppose, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what do you think are the biggest challenges facing Labour before the next election?
Well, look, the last election was bad for Labour, no doubt about that. And the last you know, I think the last few years have been bad for Labour. The, you know, I did an interview with David Lammy recently for our podcast, and he made the point, he said, when you lose that badly, when you think you might be actually doing quite well, it basically means that people have stopped listening to you. Now, Keir has, I think, got Labour back through the door, but then it's about, really, there's three things you've got to do, and you've got to do them relentlessly. I know we're talking about Volume 8, but if people go back and read Volume 1, because we won so well in 1997, people sort of, you know, you forget the detail and the work, and it was really, really, really hard every day. You've got to promote yourself and project your own ideas and values and policies relentlessly. You've got to whack the other side and, you know, whack them not just sort of picking holes and saying then and there, but whack them on their values and what they do wrong, but, you know, never stop. And above all, you've got to be developing the policy agenda. And that then you put it the next election. And I think on all three, they're kind of doing okay. But okay is not good enough. And it's certainly not good enough against this government that is utterly ruthless, is changing the rules. It's not even, you know, it's just deciding that the rules don't apply to them. So I think he's got a massive strength, which is people look at him and think, yeah, I can imagine him as a prime minister. People, I think, get that. But that's like a minimum. Yeah. And I think that because the Corbyn era was, you know, and Ed, I think, you know, I think they say in the diaries, on the day of the election, Ed thought he was going to win and Cameron thought he was going to lose. Or Cameron certainly thought, you know, he wasn't going to get a majority in 2015. Well, he did. Now, so that means the unexpected can happen. But at the moment, it feels like you've got the worst government in my lifetime. A liar and a charlatan at the top, 130,000 dead through COVID, the economy absolutely smashed, standards being ripped left, right and centre, manifestos promises being broken, corruption and cronyism, all this stuff that's going on, and yet they're ahead in the polls. Now, it's a fight. It's a hell of a fight.
I was just thinking, actually, your book is called, obviously, Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit, but the only time I can think of previously to the Olympics that had that kind of national fervour was when Tony Blair was elected for the first time. Do you think that's right? Was there the same kind of feeling then?
I think the Olympics was, I mean, don't forget, in 1997, there was that kind of amazing feeling. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of people weren't happy. They just kind of, you know, kept quiet and for a while, you know. And whereas I think the Olympics, you know, 90% of people really, 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 really enjoyed it. But yeah, that was, 97 was one of those moments. The Olympics was definitely one of those moments. Since then, you know, the Brexiteers would argue that Brexit was one of those moments. But all that Brexit's done, it seems to me, is completely divide the country even more. And Johnson deliberately exploits that all the time. He's worked out, as per Putin, as per Trump, if you get a kind of, you know, particularly with our system, if you get 35, 40% of people who, you know, will support you whatever you're doing because they like the cut of your jib or they think you're funny or you did Brexit, whatever it might be, this kind of populism that he plays to, then in our system, you can keep winning on that. That's why Labour's got to have a much bigger, they've got to take that apart, show that populism is not the answer, but then you've got to show what the answers are.
Yeah, like Michelle Obama said, where they go low, we go high, I think.
Yeah, I know, but don't forget, she said that before Trump won.
Yes, also true. Well, I have one last question for you, just kind of taking a look at the diaries as a whole. Do you take inspiration from other diarists in the field when you come to writing your own diary? Like, what is it for you? Like, is it a way of processing things or is it something just to kind of keep a reference of to look back on when you're researching?
Well, I'm in my dotage. I do read other diaries and I like diaries, but I don't know. I think you've got to do your own. And I think because the Chips Challenge diaries were, Simon Heffer's done this book recently and I will read it, but I've not read it yet, but I've read some of the reviews and sometimes they like to compare, you know, this style against that style. And I think they're very, you know, I think that's sort of, because what the diary has to reflect is the, you know, even in the, not just the writing style, but the sort of things that you focus on, the kind of, the personality of the diarist. And obviously the events that you're describing are incredibly important to anybody who wants to read it. But no, I don't sort of, I don't look at others and think, oh, I need to be a bit more like Alan Clark, or I need to be a bit more like Pepys, or I need to be a bit more like, you know, Colville, or whoever the other sort of political diarists have been. I do, you know, Alan Clark's the only one that I knew personally, and bizarrely, we had a really sort of, I'd say he was a friend, actually. We had this extraordinary kind of relationship. And I say in this one that he whenever he phoned up to have a chat, he always said to my secretary, "Tell him the other AC's on the line," and that was how he called himself. And so here's the ones that I dip into, but they're not based on anything. And I think anybody who's writing a diary, I think that'd be the wrong way to go, to think, oh, I'll model it on such and such a style.
Yes, and Challen's diaries are bitchy in the extreme, so I don't know if that's really a
Do you think mine are bitchy?
No, I don't think yours are bitchy. I think Challen's kind of stands out because he's like, oh, she looked really horrible, and she's like getting too old to get married, that kind of thing.
Right.
Whereas yours are more like, no, I think yours strike a really good balance between politics and being informative, but also your personal stuff.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it ever feels bitchy.
Okay. One thing that I did dial down on, not least under pressure from Fiona, but also from Olivia at Buy It Back, I think she had a very similar view, is that there were too many what they would define as objectifying references. You know, really gorgeous air hostess on the flight to Sydney. You know, went to the doctor. Couldn't believe how, you know, sexy the receptionist was. There was quite a lot of that. So I've not got rid of them all, but I've dialed down on that sort of stuff.
I think my favourite one was, talk to this bimbo on the train, but she actually has two doctorates. Oh, and we had a really good conversation.
Yeah, she was amazing. She got on the train, and she honestly, if you'd have sort of custom made somebody that would have been described on the front page of the Daily Mail at Aintree as a, you know, sort of bimbo, there she was. And then we got talking and she was like, you know, massive, sort of more degrees than anybody I'd ever met. Incredibly bright. Yeah, I felt a bit bad about that. But I think that's the other thing I've tried to do is, you know, the one thing I don't do is edit out the bits that maybe make me look a bit of a pillock from time to time. I think you've got to keep those in.
Yeah, I think it's it gives you a well-rounded picture, I suppose, of who you are, which is, I guess, what a diary is supposed to do. So, yeah, on that note, well, thank you very much for
My
taking
pleasure.
Time to talk to me.
No, I'd love to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If you're keen to find out more about Campbell's life during that fascinating period of recent history, then why not head to bitebackpublishing.com and check out the latest edition of his diaries, The Rise and Fall of the Olympic Spirit. It's out now, and don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.